Thank you. So it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation to come. This work on n equals 2 heterotic fluxes and their dual dual is something that I've been doing with Ruben Minkin and Stefan Tyson. And Ruben and I wrote a paper about a year ago on sort of the first part of this story. And now Stefan joined us for a elaboration and a connection to type 2, which hopefully will appear soon. I don't know. Put lots of X's. But, right. So let me start with some basic introduction and motivation of what it is that we want to do. And just in case there are some civilians who happen to wander into the audience, let me say what I mean by a flux vacuum, right? So typically we look for some solution of string theory that perhaps maybe resembles something like our world. And if we start with a nice superstring, then for example, we might try to find solutions of this form, sort of a nice compactification ansatz. And of course, clearly to do this, we need to specify some sort of metric on this compactification manifold. And what does flux vacuum mean? It means that we're not only turning on curvatures for the metric on the space, but we're also turning on curvatures for other massless 10-dimensional fields that include various fluxes. And the one that I will be mostly talking about is the heterotic flux H. So, why is it that heterotic fluxes are interesting? So, first of all, flux vacua are interesting because they allow you to look at much more general solutions to the string equations of motion than simply the sort of vanilla no-flux solutions. But flux vacua have particular advantages, which can be summarized in several three-letter acronyms as so, that we basically have a formulation for the critical string in terms of sort of a nice RNS formalism as explained by Friden, Martinek, and Schenker some time ago. And then a lot of the structure of the theories is determined by a conformal field theory, which is a nice thing to study. The disadvantages, as opposed to the perhaps one might say more popular type 2 world, is that really turning on string coupling is much more mysterious, I would say, in the heterotic string. We have a lot less of an idea of what kind of non-perturbative effects take place there. We know that they're important. We know certain examples, but perhaps we do not have as good a control. So one of the ways that one addresses this kind of issue is by constructing dual descriptions. So in everything that I'm going to be talking today, I will be talking about four-dimensional compactifications with n equals 2 spacetime supersymmetry. And the point of a dual description is that one obtains the same four-dimensional n equals 2 spacetime physics from two apparently very different starting points. So one of them is the heterotic string on something like the product of P2 times K3. I will, hopefully the rest of the talk will make it clear why this is in quotations, plus some bundle data. And this is dual under favorable circumstances to type 2A string on a Calabi-Yau threefold X. And one of the many interesting features of this duality is that the heterotic deliton, which controls the strain coupling and the strength of non-perturbative effects, is mapped to a geometric modulus on the type 2 side. So if we want to study heterotic flux vacua and we want to go beyond perturbation theory, here is a setup in which one can try to do it. Right. So the basic story that I will try to elaborate on is that is this idea that heterotic flux vacua, at least the sort of geometric ones that I'll be talking about, will be their type 2 duals will correspond to Calabi-Yau's that are admit K3 vibrations, but in general, meaning when there is non-trivial flux on the other side involved, not admitting elliptic vibrations, or at least not a compatible elliptic vibration. So that is a sort of rough message that perhaps you could take away. And now we will get to the details of the story. Okay. And
Are you going to be talking about flat space only?
Yeah. That's right. So the plan for the rest of this is sort of twofold. First, I will review this story with Ruben about what is the structure of these heterotic flux vacua in a sort of nice geometric setup. And then in the second part, I will talk about the connection to type 2, or at least what we think is the connection to type 2. OK. So to get that story set up, it actually pays to review some nice classic results. So we start with a basic working assumption that the string is weakly coupled. So the heterotic coupling is basically small. And so what that means is that the properties of this kind of compactification will be described by a superconformal field theory. And for the critical heterotic string, it better have the critical central charges. And it should have 0-1 supersymmetry. So supersymmetry on the right moving sector of the theory. The other assumption that we will make, which is actually a slightly formal assumption as far as heterotic flux vacua are concerned, but let me make it anyway. I will assume that this superconformal field theory is actually well approximated by a nonlinear sigma model. In other words, that I can try to define this theory by discussing geometry and bundles and so on. So given these two assumptions, how do we make contact with space-time supersymmetry? So actually, even without this second statement, we have a classic result of Banks et al. Connect, so SUSY, and CFT constraints. And so the basic statements are that if we actually want n equals 1 space-time supersymmetry, then we will find such a property only if the 0-1 superconformal invariance is enhanced to 0-2 supersymmetry, and the theory has integral U1R charges. A similar result is obtained for n equals 2. So Of course, if you have n equals 2, you better have n equals 1. So we start with the 0, 2. And the right moving algebra has C bar equals to 9. But it actually gets enhanced to a commuting set of algebras on the right with C bar equals to 3 and C bar equals to 6. Good job, Lauren. Right. So we basically know what kind of structure we want from our conformal field theory, and now let's apply it to the case where the conformal field theory is realized by a nonlinear sigma model.
Can I ask you a quick question about that, actually?
Yeah.
I mean, what I remember about heterotic flux vacua is that what ends up being fixed easily is not g-string, but the radius.
Right.
If the radius is going to be fixed easily with order one numbers, then presumably you're not in the geometric regime.
Right. So my nonlinear sigma model that I'll be writing is a slightly formal object, for sure. Yeah. Let me go along. part of my hope is that still the large amount of supersymmetry that one has should allow this to be maybe made into a less formal sort of construction. But you're completely right. That's why I was saying this is sort of slightly formal game that one plays. So the starting point for this nonlinear sigma model is we write down a 0, 1 superconformal, classically superconformal nonlinear sigma model. And that involves a choice of a bundle E over some 6 manifold M. And heterotic anomaly cancellation requires that we match the Pontryagin classes, the first Pontryagin classes of this bundle, to the first Pontryagin of the target. And so since this is a sigma model, it contains bosonic fields phi with some index mu running over the coordinates, which describe the map from the world sheet to the spacetime. And since we have 0, 1 supersymmetry, these guys have right moving superpartners, which I will call the psis. Right, so these live in a 0, 1 multiplet. And the left moving bundle information is carried by a vector of left moving fermions, which I will call lambda. So then one writes down a standard form for the supersymmetric action, which let me write it in a very condensed sort of form, hopefully with indices being clear. What is this called? Like DeWitt notation or something. So basically, we have sort of standard kinetic terms for the bosonic part of the theory and for the right moving and left moving fermions, and then a 4 Fermi coupling involving everyone. And these derivatives, so the derivative for the left movers is constructed by pulling back a connection, which I will call A, curly A, from the spacetime and the connection on the bundle, and the right movers, in a similar sort of fashion, are constructed by pulling back the Christoffel connection for G, twisted in some appropriate way by H, where H is the field strength of the B field, at least at tree level, but receives an important one loop in alpha prime correction, which, as everybody knows, is this difference of Chern-Simons forms for the connection on the bundle and the twisted connection. And this action has indeed 0, 1 supersymmetry. So there's an operator Q, 1, which squares to the right moving momentum, which is represented on the fields as simply the right moving translation operator. And the action of the operators on the fields is what you might expect. Like so. And you can verify easily that Q1 indeed squares to P. It's very easy to see on the phi and psi. And on the lambda, you are required to use the lambda equations of motion to show that this is true.
Sorry, Larian, is that a circular definition of H?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So the way you should think about this as an order by order expansion where you keep on putting it in. That's right. So it's circular, but still okay. So that's the basic structure we start out with, but now what we'd like to do is to see how do we get n equals 1. In other words, we need 0-2 supersymmetry on the world sheet. So, and this story was also laid out quite some time ago in one of the nice papers where this was first advertised was Holland Witten, and then a lot of what I'm going to say was given by Sen. So what's the basic idea? We need to enlarge the 0-1 to 0-2. In order to do this, we need to find a U1R symmetry with generator, let's call it R. And we need to find a supercharge Q2, right? And then the supersymmetry algebra that we wish to produce has the following non-vanishing commutators. And so, how do we do it? So, what is not too hard to argue is that this generator R must have a very specific action on the fields. Basically, the only thing that it can do is move the right moving fermions in some possibly field dependent way. So we introduce this tensor J. And then we have a simple way of constructing Q2, undoubtedly, right? Because we can simply declare that Q2 is obtained by combining this action of this generator R with the Q1, which both we know. So if we want the algebra of these defined operators to close on the phi and psi, which recall requires absolutely no equations of motion, then it's very easy to see that this tensor J squares to minus 1, so therefore is an almost complex structure, but in fact is also integrable. So we've just determined that our manifold has to be complex. The target space has to be complex. But we shouldn't go too fast because we just declared that we have this action. We haven't checked that it's a symmetry of the theory. Right? So is U1R a symmetry, we ask? And the answer is, well, it depends. So the conditions for this being a symmetry of our action are stated as follows. So first of all, we have this form that we define by lowering one of the indices of J with the metric. And this has to be anti-symmetric. So in other words, the metric G has to be Hermitian with respect to this complex structure J. We also find a condition on this three-form H that it has to be given by a certain derivative of the Hermitian form. And the third condition that we discover is that the curvature of our bundle has to be just a 1-1 form. meaning that our bundle, we might as well think of it as a holomorphic bundle over our complex target space M6. So, okay, so far it looks like we've done everything we need to obtain 0-2 supersymmetry, right? But we should also think about this sort of notion of the integral U1R charges, and in particular, how do we construct something like a spectral flow? And this part of the story was especially done nicely by this paper of Sen's. So, what Sen observed is, well, we know how to build a spectral flow operator in the nonlinear sigma model, or more appropriately, we know how to build it square. And the way we do it is we take some three-form omega and contract it into three of our right-moving fermions. So if this form is non-degenerate, so non-degenerate omega means that we can take a square root, roughly speaking, and obtain a square, the spectral flow. We also want this operator to have R charge plus 3, and we actually want it to be chiral. In other words, it should be right moving up to equations of motion. And if one analyzes these conditions, then we discover some further constraints. So first of all, we discover that the curvature has to obey Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations with zero slope. We also find that this 3-form has to be actually a 3-0 form with respect to the complex structure. And it's while d omega does not need to be closed, it should be proportional to taking omega and wedging it with a form beta. This has a nice name in this context of a Lie form. So it's a sort of a G structure language. And I don't know if maybe this is still visible. This same beta is required to show up in the closure of the Hermitian form square. So, and this basically tells us that the manifold actually has SU3 structure. And there is an additional subtlety that we need to understand. And since it's so subtle, I'll put it at the very bottom. And that's that this Lie form actually has to be exact and be given by D of the dilaton of the heterotic string. So to understand this, one can be lazy and sort of just say that, well, we know from n equals 1 space-time analysis of the supergravity that we have such a condition. And in principle, this is buried in some classic papers of Hull and Townshend, that you have this kind of integrability condition. But it's actually not straightforward to see this explicitly there. So, and this condition has a dramatic consequence for the topology of our complex manifold, right? What it tells us is that this omega up to a factor of e to the phi is closed, and so our complex manifold has trivial canonical bundle, which implies in particular that C1 of the tangent bundle is zero, but is actually a stronger constraint. This is sort of very venerable and nice stuff. And now we are, I don't know why I'm just trying to use this. This is still OK, right? Now we can use this construction and take it a step further and require that we have n equals 2 space M Susie. And so this is the story that Ruben and I carried out. I think it could have been comfortably indeed carried out shortly after the work of Banks and Dixon and Sen and so on, but was not. But it's a cute story, I think. So now, what we want to produce is this kind of enhancement from the two supercharges to four right-moving supercharges. And in particular, our starting point is that we want this C bar equals 3, 0, 2 algebra. And we want to realize it in the geometric setting, in terms of the nonlinear sigma model. And what we know about this is that it has two commuting bosonic non R U1 currents. And that suggests, and in fact, I think is essentially the only way to achieve this geometrically, is that the metric on our six-manifold slit, that is that we actually have some vibration structure where we have a four-dimensional base and over it a two-dimensional torus. So we have this picture where M6 has fibers T2. And basically, this bit is the base metric. This is the fiber metric with some possibly base-dependent metric on the fibers. And these thetas are the well-known sort of Felucci Klein forms, constructed out of choosing a connection on the base. And then we have these non-well-defined torus coordinates and theta. Yes, I will endeavor my best to distinguish the uncurly A from the curly A that made its appearance there. If you get confused, please let me know. And these guys have a curvature measured by taking D of these one forms. Right. So how are we going to see this kind of enhancement? The basic strategy that we follow is exactly the same, that we first try to find the appropriate R symmetry. Then we use the R symmetry and the known supercharges to build the rest of the supercharges. And then we ensure that the commutation relations are the ones that we like and see what conditions that imposes. So we started with this U1R symmetry. And to produce the 0,2 plus 0,4 supersymmetry algebra, we want it to be a little bit fancier, where we have an enhancement of it from the U1R to a U1 little r, and then an SU2 with three generators, r sub a, like so. And basically, the big guy is the little guy plus R3. Sort of canonical choice. And so now we build remaining generators. And check commutators. And here the trick is to basically maximally use the Jacobi identity to find a sort of minimal set of commutators to check so that you don't completely get frustrated and stop working on it. But that's possible. And when you impose the conditions, what do you learn? So first of all, you learned that this metric controlling the size of the torus is actually constant over the base. And in fact, there is a unique choice for the base geometry. So what are the provisos on this? First of all, I'm looking at cases where I'm actually turning on a non-trivial topological flux. So otherwise, one could have had a T4 here, but T4 does not support a non-trivial solution to the Bianchi identity. K3 does. So the basic game is that using the conditions, you show that the base has to be a hyper-hermitian manifold, a compact hyper-hermitian manifold with exact Lie form on it. And these are classified, and the classification is this.
Combined with all the supersymmetry conditions.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can put H once on the
torus. Right. But if you want n equals 1, then yeah.
So it's a combination of Susie and
And Bianchi.
They're actually static solutions with T4. They're just n equals 0.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's
the
static ones have some curvature in the rest of the
division. Yeah, the vibration of the two circles are vibrating over T4.
Just a dumb question. Over here you had beta, which was d phi, so yeah. There's a deltan gradient, at least in the general solution.
Yeah.
So once there's a deltan gradient, can you really use the strict language of world shaping formal field theory?
This is
actually one thing we don't have is a good conformal field theory. I'm wondering if you do here or not. Or.
Well, so first of all, my dilaton gradient is, the dilaton never goes to any funny values, right? It stays bounded. That's perhaps the fastest answer to answer your question. So, to the extent to which you believe this nonlinear sigma model with a finite radius T2, it's okay. Right. So, this is our first statement. So, we have this K3 base. The next statement is that the curvatures for describing the T2 vibration are actually anti-self dual connections over this K3. In other words, if we take, so on the K3 we have these three self dual forms, let me call them omega A, and the wedge of them with any one of our curvatures has to vanish. And finally, the connection, the curly A, not to be confused with the uncurly, is constructed by pulling back a connection on a bundle over the base, and then choosing some Wilson lines, which I'll call with these little a parameters. So this connection is constrained to be, again, Hermitian-Yang-Mills on the base with zero slope, and these little a's are constant and commuting with everything in sight Wilson lines. So the cuteness of this world sheet argument to me is that we've done a sort of fairly general analysis of the conditions, and what we find as the possible solutions are exactly the solutions that have been used in the supergravity world as an ansatz. That people basically said, well, let us construct solutions to the supergravity equations of motion on T2 bundles over K3 with this kind of structure. So
they're not really products, right?
That's the point.
That their anti-subdual collection exists there is that they're not really a product. And then.
Right. What you have is a principal torus bundle in general over K3.
So there's no zero section or anything like that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and that will be important in the discussion of duality. As a sort of a simple corollary to this, one can take the Bianchi identity, right? Basically, it's hiding here somewhere, right? Take the D of this, and you get the usual heterotic Bianchi identity. And in a sense, it boils down to a statement defined on the base manifold S. And you can take, so it gives you some four form on the manifold S that has to vanish, and in particular, you can take that four form and integrate it over S, and you obtain a constraint from the integrated Bianchi identity, integrated on S, and what it tells you is that the things that you might have naively thought of as sort of moduli of this solution are in fact fixed. So what do I have here? The 24 you recognize as the second Chern class of the tangent bundle of K3. This turn class of the E hat, that's describing this bundle over the base. And then on the left-hand side here, we have our constant metric. We have our Wilson lines. And don't worry, these terms are both positive with the definition of trace that we have, because they're both contributing in the same way. And here we have a product of the first turn classes for our curvatures integrated over the K3. Right? And so if you thought that, oh, you know, I can just come along and start tuning the size of the torus, for example, you've been cruelly deceived because there are sort of integral constraints, right? This is an integral matrix, this is some integer, and you can't move it too much.
Sorry, and by the connection between P1s, that integer is a 24. Maybe I'm forgetting which A that is.
Sorry?
The second Turing class of E hat isn't related to the second Turing class of the tangent bundle by your constraint on P1 over there?
No, this is the... Right. Basically, if you were just playing K3,
yeah,
right, then your equation would be blah equals zero. What is happening here is that by the time you've transferred the statement from six dimensions to four, you find these additional contributions from the circles, from the torus circles. And the important statement for this sort of, you know, can you wiggle the T2, is that basically the circles up to factors of metric and so on, their curvatures are contributing in the same way for the sign as do stable holomorphic bundles. So everything pushes you too much, and you cannot, you know, sort of take a large N kind of limit where you would let some integers get large and the torus sizes get arbitrarily big. That you cannot do.
I'm slightly confused by the language you just used. I mean, with this kind of vibration, I can go to eight dimensions and then four, because I've got the T2. But you just talked about going to six and the four.
So
you can't really wrap it.
No, sorry, I didn't mean that. I meant that I have this compact six-dimensional manifold,
right?
And there's a statement about the anomaly on that. By sort of working through explicit forms of the H and so on that I get, I boil it down to a statement of just over S. So I don't mean to say that, yeah.
It's an anomaly calculation, not a physical reduction.
No, you're right, exactly, yeah.
Which anomaly is it? Is this a Gauss's law thing?
So what this is, so it's take this beast, right, and do the usual equals to up to factors, right, trace curly F squared minus trace R squared.
So it's kind of the number of five grams, basically, and has to add them to zero.
Right, except,
it's Gauss's law.
Yeah, yeah, and here I guess I have no five grams, so. I could, right? Right, that would add a term. But I'm constructing explicitly a smooth solution here.
Yeah,
by assumption.
All of the fibrins have a throat that you could describe using.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's already in there.
Is it included in this class?
Or do you think it was changing the topology?
I guess my guess would be, yeah, that it would change the topology. But, so, for example, yeah.
That should be allowed, right? Maybe there aren't any static solutions.
If I try to do five-brain kinds of things, then it's very hard to have sort of compact target spaces here. If you don't... and that also has to do with this... this constraint on the exactness of the Lie form.
You can't wrap the fibrin on a T2 and just puncture S at some points. I mean,
I think you probably can.
Yeah.
But I won't see that in a nice sort of just plain vanilla nonlinear sigma model, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree. The fibrin into the story, you're going to have trouble describing it.
Yeah. But I think, you know, their contributions will show up as an integer here.
Yeah,
And you can trade more ingredients against each other, right? Okay. So that's a story of how to build a geometric realization of this kind of heterotic supersymmetry. And it's kind of nice. The thing that we got interested in is here, you know, every monkey can see how to build a 0,2 plus a 0,4 if you just have a T2 that doesn't interact with a K3. You have a simple way of writing all the generators of supersymmetry. But it takes a slightly smarter monkey to realize that you can have the same structure even though the T2 is in a sense interacting with the K3, fibered over it. And yet you still have this split and you still have the commuting supercharges. It's kind of neat. Of course, it's sort of happy, but it's nice to have the explicit form. I should say it would also be cool if one could sort of realize this kind of construction in some sort of superspace a little bit more explicitly without writing complex structures. So that's hard.
Is there a connection between the data entering here and data you get by trying to do gaugings of just heterotic vacuum on K3 times T2?
Yes. So I will, in a sense, have something to say about that. And it goes back to your days of youth.
Those are over. Dave, I'm so old, I didn't even realize that.
One can still be young at heart, I'm told. No?
I forgot.
Okay, so now let me switch from this story to a discussion of heterotic type 2 duality. And let me begin with some basic constraints on the story, which were elucidated by Paul Aspinwall with his usual penchant for preciseness and finality in his notes on N equals 2 compactifications from 2000. And so what we learn are the following statements. So if we have a weakly coupled heterotic string that is dual to a large radius limit of a 2A compactification on our Calabi-Yau X, then X must be a K3 fibered K3. Must be K3 fibered. So that's statement number one, and it has, as you can see, some provisos. And statement number two is that if the heterotic compactification has a decompactification limit, where we take the supposed T2 times K3 and decompactify the torus, then X must also admit a compatible elliptic vibration. And so, if one is asking questions about what are possible type 2 duals of these backgrounds, where clearly we're constraining the torus, the natural thing to do is keep A because it's nice, but maybe we should drop B. And to illustrate that this is not a crazy idea, we consider one of the classic examples of this duality, And as an example that was provided by Shaman and Professor Vafa. Not that you're not a professor. And they tell us the following nice story. So let's start with the V8 times V8 string and compactify it on T2. But let's do something fun and take a special point in the moduli of T2, where tau equals rho. And what that leads to is a standard stringy enhancement, so that the 8-dimensional gauge group, well, of course, we haven't done anything to the V8s. But now we get an additional stringy SU2. And we have the remaining U1 symmetries of our friend, the torus. So the next step is that we compactify further. On a K3. And of course, when we do this, we have to satisfy anomaly cancellation. And so we have to pick some instantons for the bundle, for this gauge group. And the choice that they suggest is that we take an SU2 instanton with instanton number 10 in each of the E8s. And an SU2 instanton with instanton number 4 in the stringy SU2. Right. So then, once one does this, of course, these guys are no longer part of the gauge symmetry in the 4-dimensional theory. But there is a gauge symmetry in the 4-dimensional theory, which is an E7 squared. Right. So that's the maximal. The commutant of SU2 in E8, of course. And nothing happens to our friends, the U1s. But in addition, there is charged matter in the 56 representations of the E6 for each, in the 56th representation of the E7. For each of the E7s, so you have these half hypers in the 56, and that is enough to completely Higgs the theory by going on the Higgs branch. We can completely get rid of the non-abelian symmetry, and that's the last step. And we obtain a 4-dimensional gauge group of U1 cubed. Now, one of these beasts has to be the gravi-photon of the n=2 theory, and that means that we have at the end, two vector multiplets, and doing a count of the remaining neutral hypermultiplets, we have 129. And if one looks for what is the possible 2A dual of this, well, so these numbers should be H11 of X, if there is a dual, and this guy should be H12 of X plus 1. And if we look at these beasts, then, well, there is a nice possibility, and that's degree 12 hypersurface in P4, 1, 1, 2, 2, 6. And this manifold has the structure of a K3 fibered manifold, but not an elliptically fibered one. So there are certain conditions that the divisors on the hypersurface have to satisfy in order to have a K3 vibration or an elliptic vibration, and here those are just not satisfied. Indeed, if we ask for a compatible set of two vibrations, then H11 had better be greater than or equal to 3, and here it's 2. So this is an example of a heterotic dual of a non-elliptically fibered K3 fibered Calabi Yau. And it's very important that the we don't believe this just because of the numerology. I mean, that's very nice, but there are very many ways to construct integers in principle. There are also non-trivial checks. Of the prepotentials, F0 and F1, on the vector moduli space.
Wasn't there some story about finding the silent wind curve on the
side? Right, because this is actually what you have here is when you tune to tau equals rho equals to I, then you get an SU2 without any extra nasty matter. So you really have a sort of nice, like the original Seiberg-Witten story. Indeed, so showing that you have this kind of SU2 enhancement, right, on both sides, on the heterotic side it's easy to see, and you also might want to see it on the type 2 side, it was an important part of the of determining the map and also sort of checking the story. So, but what I want to stress is that there are checks here that have been done that are pretty convincing and involve not just matching two integers. And, okay, so given the sort of thing that I've been selling you, you might want to ask if this is a heterotic flux vacuum. And the answer is yes. So what we can do is we can represent the T2 at tau equals rho by a WZW model, an SU2 times U1 WZW. And then basically performing the same trick that Alan did for fibering WZW models over GLSMs, we can fiber WZW models over NLSMs. And what this amounts to is gauging the SU2 left of the WZW model. And finally, we can verify that the structure does indeed have the enhanced supersymmetry that we expect. And it's all there. And the construction is just a slight generalization of the torus story that I just gave you. So this seems to fit into the sort of heterotic flux picture pretty nicely. And I want to end by giving you another example of what one can do. And here's the game. So what we're going to try to do is make a heterotic flux dual to another famous hypersurface, which is the optic in P411222. So this again has the structure of a K3 fibered Calabi Yau, but not elliptically fibered. And how do we get to it? Well, so we start the same way. We can think first by going down to 8 dimensions. But this time, the new twist is to put in a non-trivial Wilson line that will break one of our E8s to E7 times U1. So the 8-dimensional gate group that we obtain is E8 times E7 times E8 times U1 to the fifth. And so the U1 to the fourth from the torus, we're not doing now something funny to tau and rho, and the extra U1 from the Wilson line. So our second step is to compactify on the K3 and choose some funny instanton numbers for two SU2s inside the E7 times E8, in this notation, times E7. But we'll also play an extra trick of turning on abelian instantons on the K3 for two of these U1s. And, well, two of them are coming. Well, at least one of them is coming from the torus. Right. So then, in four dimensions, the gauge group you obtain is E7 times SO12 times U1 cubed. And we can completely Higgs the non-abelian sector again. There's enough charged matter to do that. And presto, you find two vector multiplets and 87 hypers, which is just what you would expect from this example. There's a fun subtlety in doing this counting of the moduli. One has to realize that abelian instantons obstruct geometric deformations of the K3. But OK, that's something one can understand.
So did you present the example backwards? In other words, first you did this, and you found those Hodge numbers, and then you thought, oh, it must be.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, you can check pre-potentials and so on.
This is the part where the story currently is stupider than this. So
one of your collaborators is a great pre-potential guy.
I know.
This is why the paper's not out yet, I guess.
Right. Right. No. So that's exactly the point. Is can we do that kind of more detailed check of the prepotentials to really start believing this instead of just matching pairs of integers, which the excitement sort of ends after about 3 weeks, I think. maybe it's different for different people. And so that's what we're working on now. It's a little bit more involved because this example was sort of chosen with. How to say it with astuteness. So there's a great deal of symmetry here that simplifies a lot of the perturbative heterotic computations that one needs to do. Basically, one is playing with a particularly simple presentation of this O22 moduli space. And now we need to play with the moduli space that involves a non-trivial Wilson line, which is not at all impossible, but it's sort of less symmetric and requires, one can't just sort of pick it up from somewhere and use it. I think we need to do further computations. There's also a certain worrying embarrassment of riches. So I didn't tell you here, for example, which abelian instanton I chose, which class. And at this level, choose two classes that are independent, and you get the same number. Does this mean that somehow secretly all of these are giving you the same thing? Is there one that's particularly good? It's not completely clear.
I think there may be more than one Calabi-Yau with Hodge numbers 2, 6.
That could be. How many do you know?
From
pre-potentials. Right.
I think I know 2.
You? Okay.
Look at the example.
You get a different 286.
Not absolutely
the same. Yeah, I think it's the same.
Okay.
I think it's the same.
It's the conical transition from the quintic?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the same beast. But okay, yeah, that's something we can. Right. Yeah, it could be that I've just discovered lots of different 286 Calabi-Yaus right now. So yes, that's the next step is to actually do this kind of more detailed check. I mean, one kind of sanity check that we do have in addition to the Hodge numbers is that there is also an SU2 enhancement here. Basically, when you turn off the Wilson line, you get back the SU2 that was there. And one can also see that kind of SU2 enhancement on the type 2 side, indeed without weird extra charged matter by using the story that you and Sheldon and Ronan worked out. So that kind of rough check also works. So there's some, I think, fun stuff to do with these heterotic flux vacua and trying to find their type 2 duals. One could contemplate sort of more systematic searches for examples. One certainly needs to do this sort of pre-potential analysis. And once we have that down, then we can start talking about maps between the two descriptions and potentially getting a control of the non-perturbative effects in these heterotic flux vacua, which I think would be a neat little addition. And of course, as any person who works on n equals 2 must say, at some point, it would be really exciting to extend this to n equals 1. Having already gone by an integer, I will not continue to the next integer. So thank you for your attention.
Are there any questions?
So a lot of n equals 2 examples that are T2 federations are T-dual or non-T-dual. So to T2 cross Columbia, cross K3 plus some bundle. So two questions. First off, can you see whether all of them are? I mean, I thought the answer was all of them were, but is that in fact the case? And secondly, can you play T2LA games to translate this into an easier period of calculation?
Right. So that's a good question. I do not know that all of them are. I mean, maybe you can tell me why you think you can get all. Yeah. No, that is not so clear. But indeed, these sort of T2-ality orbits can be part of the answer to this question of, have I found an embarrassment of riches? It might be that many of the choices that I can make are just relabelings, right? To me, I feel like once I have the prepotential computation in some order, then I can start thinking about these questions a little bit more concretely. So, but yeah.
Any more questions?
Thank you.